Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by you, dear listener, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are going to talk about NAFTA this week, because it matters, because the president wants to change it, because it has changed our lives. And a lot of people, you know, when we went out and asked them for all that it is important about, they didn't know what it was. Here you go.
NAFTA could not tell you. What is it?
What is NAFTA?
Never heard of it before.
NAFTA. I know this answer, but I don't know this answer.
NAFTA, National Association of I don't know what.
North American, National, I'm close though.
It's a free trade agreement between America, Canada, and Mexico to, yeah, I don't know. That's about as much as I can get.
So the reason I love that tape is because it's really illustrative, right? Illustrative. Reporters should always, when they're working on a story, go ask people if they know what, like, the bones of the story is, because, you know, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that's what we're going to be talking about. And if you just say NAFTA and people don't know it, that's kind of a problem, right?
Yeah, I like the guy my favorite is the guy who's like, I'm really close, though, because I got North America.
I know.
The two words. But it makes you realize how long ago the 90s were.
Oh, you're
killing
me.
It just really makes you realize, wow, this was, no, I mean, it hurts me too, man. It hurts me too. But so NAFTA, it has been invisibly woven into the fabric of our lives since so long ago in the 90s. And now, considering that Donald Trump and members of his cabinet say they're going to renegotiate the whole thing or maybe just throw it out, we thought that was a great opportunity for us to make ourselves smart about it. So Kai went around and asked complete strangers about their pants.
I did. That's true. I did. I went down the street and I said, excuse me. I literally said, can I talk to you about your pants for a minute? Anyway, I got to do that and you somehow got the better end of the deal. You had avocado toast. It didn't get any for me, even though that's my breakfast of choice. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you have it every day while I'm having my cold waffle. So I figured, you know.
That's not my fault.
I was taking my chance. I want you to know that yesterday's leftover breakfast, and this is bad. This is like not good. It was the fried egg that the yolk broke on that Eli wouldn't eat.
That.
My child would
not
eat.
Of course not, because then the yolk gets gross.
So I ate that, half a slice of cold turkey bacon, and then the two stray fish sticks because I made him fish tacos for his lunch. And that was all I ate until like 4 o'clock. I like really need to do something about this. Maybe I need to get some breakfast bars. Anyway, that does not have anything to do with NAFTA, but the avocado toast and the pants both do. So we're going to get to that in a minute. And of course, we're going to answer some of the questions that you guys have about NAFTA. And so thanks for sending those.
Here comes confession time, by the way. This is going to drop Tuesday of the week. I guess it's 28th. And I will actually be on vacation. So we are pre-taping this the week prior. And it's just because we want to get something in the feed for us all to get smart about.
That's not true. It's because it's still relevant and also kind of a spring break.
That too. Sorry. Of course.
All right. Let's get into it.
Of course.
So the reason we're talking about NAFTA right now is because obviously President Trump has brought it up a lot, and he brought it up a lot on the campaign trail. Here's just one of those examples.
I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement.
Oh, that was so loud. And then just earlier this month, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, had this much quieter thing to say.
Well, as you know, the first on our agenda is NAFTA.
All right. So what do you think? Donald Trump says it's super easy to renegotiate this huge trade deal.
Which in point of fact is not true. And so for the series on NAFTA that we did for Marketplace on the Radio, we got Carla Hills, the American negotiator for NAFTA, Michael Wilson, the Canadian negotiator for NAFTA, and Jaime Serra, the Mexican negotiator. We talked to them all, and there's a funny story we're going to play you later about a baseball game and how that helped the NAFTA negotiations go. But I asked Carla Hills, we're going to play two pieces of tape from Carla Hills, the U.S. negotiator for NAFTA. And I asked her, first of all, what she thought about the president's proposals that he made during the campaign and which he has made since about getting tariffs back on the American trade negotiating table, you know, extra tariffs. Here's what she said.
Since 60% of our imports are used for intermediate goods by the manufacturers that export, it would create a burden upon them. And we have 5 million jobs that are related to our exports. We would be hurt.
All right. So the idea there is if you bought an American-made T-shirt, but the cotton didn't come from the U.S., if it came from China or India, then you'd be paying those taxes, tariffs?
Tax and tariffs, right? It charges import duties that are placed on imported goods, right? That's a good thing to mention. But but about the idea of replacing big multilateral trade deals with many, many countries with smaller bilateral deals with individual countries, here's what Carla Hills had to say about that.
With respect to bilateral agreements, we have to keep in mind that 90% of our exporters are small and medium-sized businesses. That is not in volume, but in terms of numbers. And our small and medium-sized businesses are the ones that are the great job producers in the United States. If they have to learn the rules that go, let me say, with 164 countries that make up the WTO, believe me, their hair is going to be on fire.
I thought that was great. Carla Hills is like 85, and she's saying hair is going to be on fire. So here's what that means, right? If you run a small and medium-sized business, or we're going to talk to a couple of them later on the show, you have to know the rules for all of those different countries instead of just, you know, one set of rules that everything is going to be governed by, and it goes on and on from there.
Which one is NAFTA? Is it a bilateral trade agreement or a multilateral trade agreement?
Multilateral.
What is that? I feel like I know what bilateral means and I know what multilateral means, but when they come in the context of trade agreements, I don't know.
Right. So multi, many, and there's bi is two. And so NAFTA is a three-way, it's technically a trilateral trade deal, but you don't want to go there, right? So which gets me to the jargony thing, right?
That's specific.
So here's the promise, and let's try to do this. Don't say bilateral, multilateral, or tariff. How about in the next, like, okay, however long we go in this program, and we'll see what happens. Does that make sense?
Can I say trilateral?
No.
Trilateral sounds like a CrossFit thing, so I'm probably not going to say that. All right. That is a good promise about the jargon. We will try to stay away from that because that keeps happening in the NAFTA discussion, I feel like it's already complicated, and it makes it even sound harder than it is. All right. We are eating the avocado toast next up, labels on our blue jeans. That did happen. That's all coming up, though, after we pay the bills.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. This is the part of the show where we're going to talk about NAFTA being woven into the fabric of our lives. And if you remember the 90s, you're singing the cotton song right now.
The cotton song?
Are you? The cotton song. Cotton, the fabric of our lives.
How old are you? See what I did there? I don't remember the cotton song. Is the fabric of our lives? I don't know. Something like that.
Maybe it's not cotton. No, I think it's cotton.
I don't know.
Some, you know what? You know who's going to know? You, dear listener, because none of us is smart as all of us.
Hit us up. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Tell us about the cotton song. Send us a little clip because clearly I'm lame. I don't know.
Better yet, sing it. All right. Let's talk about NAFTA in your everyday life. Eggplant in February, avocados all year round, tomatoes whenever you want them. That is all actually thanks to NAFTA, which made it way easier for us to get produce, fruits and vegetables all of the year when those items are not seasonal in the U.S. And those items, a lot of them actually come from California. And so we're starting with avocado because it is a straightforward example that is also relevant to my interests.
What food?
just avocado on everything all the time. That's what I had for breakfast. You know, yesterday. Okay. Our awesome producers and our awesome intern, Maria, found us a distributor, a fruits and vegetables distributor, Karen Salinger. She's the director of sales and co-owner of this company with an impossible name called Veritable Vegetable. She helped me out on that one, though.
Oh, you can say VV. A lot of people call us VV for short. We are organic wholesale distribution company, and we've been operating in San Francisco since 1974. We were the first organic produce distribution company in the nation.
And since you started the company so long ago, you were there when NAFTA went into effect.
Correct.
What kind of a change was that?
So, you know, the biggest change that happened when NAFTA went into effect is that we started to see a lot more produce coming into the United States from Mexico. There used to be a lot of product gaps. you know, once the California growing season ended, you know, we would see a gap in supply. So there wouldn't be any eggplant. There wouldn't be any zucchini. I'm talking organic here specifically, but, you know, there wouldn't be any of these commodities. Post-NAFTA, there started to be much more of a flow of these items. You know, it took a while, but, you know, now there's just essentially there's absolutely no gap in supply on any of these items.
So what do you think if NAFTA went away or was substantially renegotiated? You know, last year there was like an avocado shortage, and I can tell you that me and all my friends freaked out completely. What would happen if NAFTA suddenly went away and we had to pay more for Mexican avocados?
I believe what would happen is that, and I've been told this by specifically by a grower in Mexico, and in some of the things that I read, that they would start to look for other markets outside of the United States to ship avocados. It's such a huge crop now in Mexico, in Michoacán, that they would have to find other outlets. And they don't believe that, you know, we here in the United States would pay such a big increase, big price increase on avocados. However, the same grower that I talked to said that it's very unlikely that fruits and vegetables are going to be subject to a new tax/tariff coming into the United States. It's just way too impactful.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how worried are you about your business overall?
Not worried. You know, not worried about the business. You know, I mean, if NAFTA is renegotiated to the point where there is a tax put on, let's just say they put a tax on avocados, everybody would be impacted if all of this food product starts to be taxed coming into the United States. Everybody would be paying a higher price and everybody would be up in arms.
Is there a single product that you can point to that would be impacted the most? We're talking about avocados just because, you know, that's so emblematic, but is there something in particular that you can think of that you'd be really worried about that's not that?
I would say probably tomatoes. I would say I would be most worried about tomatoes because there's a huge supply of tomatoes that comes from Mexico in the, you know, off in the California, you know, when California doesn't have a growing season for tomatoes. So that would probably be the biggest thing. People want tomatoes all year round, even if they're not technically in season in California.
Tomatoes and avocado, pretty much guacamole going down the drain.
Going down the drain. Do you remember when you were, so I grew up in New York after we got back from Europe, right? I was 10, 11, 12 when we got back. There were no avocados, man. There were no tomatoes in the middle of the winter. It was craziness, yeah. Right? And now you're like, it's all there.
You know, one thing that was really interesting too is that she said after NAFTA, avocados didn't necessarily flood. You know, if you go to the middle of the country and order a California burger, it has avocado on it. But immediately after NAFTA, where avocados started getting distributed the most was actually New England.
Oh, wow.
And didn't, like, Mexican avocados didn't actually make their way into California because California was pretty protective of the market.
Sure.
Because we grow a lot here until the 2000s, mid-2000s.
Wow.
It was really interesting. But now everybody is, you know, pretty dependent. And the reason that I asked her about the price increase was just to get a sense of how people might react if the price of avocados went up because of the additional fees, the taxes, the T word.
Nicely done. Good T-word. Job. I was like, wait, what's she clearing her throat? What is she doing? Oh, no. It's
so
her
close.
Little challenge.
So I thought this is the time for boots on the ground, right? Like, what would happen to the local business if there was an issue, an avocado disruption? So I talked to Kevin Mitchell, who's the general manager at Cafe St. George in San Francisco, and their avocado toast is on a bunch of the best of lists for San Francisco. So I went there to both test it and ask him what he thought.
Okay. All
right. I have a problem, which is I need a knife and fork for this. Okay. Tell me your name and then tell me what I'm looking at right here.
My name is Kevin Mitchell. I'm the general manager at Cafe St. George, and you are currently looking at a very delicious piece of avocado chili toast.
What? How many avocados are on this one piece of toast?
Probably almost one, maybe more. It looks like more than that. It kind of varies, but yeah, it's probably about a whole avocado, a pretty large one at that.
Mm-hmm. So, like, how many avocados would you estimate that you go through a day then? It seems like it's, I mean, how many of these do you think get ordered?
Depends on the day. On the weekend, we can easily sell 50 or more. We go through just cases and cases of avocados a week. Definitely, at the very minimum, a case a day.
Yeah. Were you here for the 2016, you know, the great avocado shortage of 2016? What, were there riots in the streets? Like, what was happening?
I think, what is it, like November, December, something like that, avocado prices basically doubled. So it can be up to like $120, $130 a case, which is pretty drastic. I mean, any doubling of produce prices is kind of unheard of. I mean, I've been in the industry a long time. You don't see that too often. There's some problems with trade in Mexico and certain situations going down. So we just actually had to completely stop it for a while, which was quite a shock to a lot of our customers. We had to like put up signs and stuff, and people would just look at with a blank slate, like, what do you mean there's no avocados? Yeah. Like, we just ruined their day.
Yeah, totally. You kidding me?
Ruined the day. But I have to say, Kevin was up on the global landscape, and he had a really interesting thing to say about what would happen if all of a sudden we had to go back to the world of seasonal produce. Here's what he said about that.
Okay. I kind of find it funny that people, you know, completely accept that Girl Scout cookies are seasonal, but like strawberries, they can't understand why that would be a thing, you know?
Right. Especially considering that the Girl Scout cookie shortage is manufactured, because you could sell them whenever you wanted. All you have to do is make them. And the seasonal strawberry thing is actually real.
This is a real thing. Exactly. Yeah. Except it doesn't feel real because NAFTA. All right. So then I said, Kevin, what are you going to do if the prices go up? Here's that conversation. How much does this avocado toast cost?
$6.
How much do you think people would be willing to pay for it if all of a sudden it was way harder to get?
I mean, you know, it's hard for us because avocado prices in general have kind of been steadily going up, but we really try not to charge more than that. Like, as you could see, it's a pretty great portion of toast. You know, I feel proud of it. I feel at $6, it's a good price. But, you know, if the quality is not there and it's too expensive, you know, we're really going to have to think about other options.
$6 avocado toast. This is going to make me sound like a cheapskate, but that seems pretty steep. I don't know.
This is reminding me that recently there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle on SFGate about how there used to be an outcry about $4 toast in San Francisco, but now it's even more expensive.
Wow.
But I thought it was a little disingenuous because then the article included toast that has avocado on it and even toast that has crab on it.
I'm oh, like, well, yeah. Please, shut up. Come
I know.
On. Right?
Of course that's expensive. I feel like $6 for I was full for the rest of the day. Like, it was a major, it was like about 1.5-inch thick slice of bread and then an entire avocado. So I thought $6 was actually a fair price.
Was it good sourdough bread? Was it good San Francisco sourdough?
You know, no. It was, like, not to disparage Cafe St. George, but it was like oat bread.
Oh, yeah. God, how to ruin a piece of avocado toast.
I
All right.
I like mine on sourdough. I like a little less lemon and a little more sea salt, and I like okay. an egg on top. Okay. Although I should point out, you can order it with an egg on top, which is clutch. That's clutch.
All right.
There are pictures, by the way. Yes. Pictures of the avocado toast on our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart.
Sea salt, please. Could I have some sea salt with my avocado toast? Thank you, NAFTA. All right, so
I like the flaky kind.
We're going to segue from that to me chasing people down the street wanting to talk about their blue jeans. And here's why they're doing that, right? If you think about what has happened to American industry and American manufacturing, that's the thing that people like Wilbur Ross and President Trump and all the critics of NAFTA say, listen, American manufacturing has gone down the drain because of NAFTA. And if you look at just the numbers, part of what's going on here, especially in textiles, is that cheaper manufacturing, the cheaper assembly of jeans, has gone, in point of fact, to Mexico. So here's the deal. After I chased people down the street asking them about their pants, I asked them three questions. I said, listen, how much did they cost? Where were they made? And do you care where they were made? Mm. And I asked because we had had a guy on Marketplace a couple of weeks ago. His name is Peter Kim, and he runs a company called Hudson Jeans. It's a high-end jean manufacturer here, based here in Los Angeles, that does a lot of its work.
Oh.
Yeah, does a lot of its work.
I have some of those jeans.
There you go. Okay, so that, oh my God, I wish I'd known, because we would have set this up totally differently. Anyway, high-end jeans made by a company here in Los Angeles, but manufactured, put together, assembled down in Mexico, right? And let's remember, all this stuff gets marked up like a zillion times, right? He buys the fabric from Italy and Turkey. He imports it here. He pays a duty to get it into this country. But then he does a little bit of work on it here, ships it down to Mexico duty-free. They do a bunch of work there. They only pay duty on the value added. Then it comes back, right? And then, you know, they're marked up like three times by the time you get them in the store. Anyway, So just to get a sense of the process, I asked Peter Kim, well, here, let's play the tape.
You source your denim overseas, right? Italy is now what you're
Italy
talking?
And Turkey.
In Turkey, right? And then what is it that gets done in Mexico?
So for us, we are doing a full package deal out there. So we partnered up with two really good factories. These guys are responsible for start to finish. All we have to do is spot check it in between.
All right, so let's remember the through line here. The takeaway from this NAFTA special we're doing is how NAFTA and its effects on this economy have become ingrained in our lives. There are factories now down in Mexico, and let's remember it's a three-way deal, right? It's a three-way deal. There are right. factories down in Mexico now that are set up with what are called full package deals. So you can go down there and you can order a la carte and you can just say, listen, I want the wash done on this fabric, or you can do the full package deal, which Peter Kim has done, and you ship it down there and they do the whole smash and they ship it back. And obviously, it's a cost savings for Peter Kim, but I asked him this question when we went down to talk to him.
Could you see a day when you bring production back here to the States?
It's a constant conversation that we have. We actually still do production here. We probably do 15-20%. One of the benefits, I think, about domestic is speed. If something goes wrong, we can react much quicker and make adjustments. Like on the fly, whereas if it's, you know, in Mexico or anywhere else, you have that transit time. And I was literally right before you guys came in, I was sitting down with a factory here, a domestic factory, talking about longer term strategy.
So this is what you call radio synergy here. We found the company, the factory that Peter Kim was talking to about bringing production back here. It's run by, well, yeah, we did. Yeah, it's production excellence by Bridget Bodner and Daisy Palacios. But anyway, I blow it off like that. No, it was extraordinary that they found him. But anyway, his name is Monty Galbraith, and he runs a company called DNA Textiles Group. They're in Columbus, Georgia. And here's what you need to know about textile manufacturing in the United States, okay? When NAFTA was signed, there were 500,000 people in this country working in textiles. There are now 100,000 people, just over 100,000 people working in textiles. There were 15 mills that made denim, textile mills that made denim. Now there are 3 mills that make denim. DNA Textile Group in Georgia, run by Monty Galbraith, is one of them. And so I asked him along the lines of, listen, this is now ingrained in this economy. I said, listen, why do you still need NAFTA if NAFTA has done such damage to the American textile industry? Here's what he said.
Well, you know, that's kind of a loaded question. You know, NAFTA 20 some odd years ago, when it was put into place, it, you know, just shattered the textile industry in the U.S. This was a healthy, thriving industry that's now just a shadow of its former self. But as of now, the way that it has settled in, where the production has kind of right-sized to the marketplace today, the way it's working now is the fabrics that we produce in the States do go into Mexico duty-free. And then they come back and finish garments duty-free. So therefore, if NAFTA goes away, those rolls of fabric that we would ship into Mexico to be made into garments and come back, full duty would be applied to the total value of that garment coming back. And
could you stay in business if NAFTA went away?
You know, if it went away, which I don't think it is. I think it's going to get renegotiated, and I don't have any inside information, but I've got to believe that there's so many industries, major industries in the U.S. that are so entrenched in the supply chain as the way it flows back and forth between Canada, U.S., and Mexico. But yeah, if you were to take NAFTA and put a 20% border tax on everything coming back, yeah, it would definitely put us out of business. No doubt about it. Because the products that we make all ship down to Mexico duty-free, and they all have to return duty-free. And if that advantage was taken away, it would put us out of business.
So that's the moral of the story, right? It is that while it was bad for American textiles, and there's a lot of reasons, right? Automation is one, and cheaper manufacturing in Asia is another one. But NAFTA did a number on textiles in the United States. But the deal is it is now baked into the economy. And the reason that you can get a $25 pair of jeans is because of NAFTA. The reason, as Molly was talking about, the reason you can get, an avocado piece of toast is because of NAFTA. I mean, you know.
I got my Hudson jeans at Nordstrom Rack.
Hudson jeans.
I do anyway. Just want to point that down. So I probably only had the double markup, not the triple markup that you would get if I got them at Anyway, I'm super excited about that because I just discovered this brand of jeans. And the right white jeans are really hard to find. Anyway, we didn't even get into the Canada part. Like, I assume there's a whole other level of import-export issues that come from the Canada part. But it sounds like that's not so much about manufacturing. It's more about...
it's not as free trade
of goods back and forth.
Yeah, it's not as politically freighted, right? Because it's just not as loaded. Anyway, there are some questions that we're going to take from you guys after a little bit of a quick break here, and then we'll get some listener questions. So let's do that. All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they are going to love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, or anybody you care about. What podcast would they really, really like to hear?
All right, you got that person in your head. Now go do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how to download them. Please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. And thanks for spreading the word. All right, we have been on our little jeans and avocados journey. It is time to see if we can answer some questions from all of you listeners out there. We asked, you sent them in, and let's get to them.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
I like that. That's a great little sting. I like that. That's awesome.
It's so good.
I know. And y'all are sending in voice memos, vocal clips with your questions. And so let's hit the first one. It's John Harper, and here's his question.
You mentioned in one of your previous podcasts that free trade agreements are generally speaking a good thing. One criticism that I've heard, and particularly during the presidential campaign, was that while they may have a positive impact on GDP growth, they also tend to increase income inequality. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
So here's the thought. Yes, that's true. And here's why. Even though the rising tide economically from free trade does lift all boats, most of the benefits, right, most of the gains accrue to the owners of capital, the people who own the plants and the machinery and all of that jazz, because they can then maximize their profits. It is not a great thing for, and as we've seen and as we saw in this election campaign, free trade is not always a great thing for the working classes in this country or any country, right? And that's the dilemma.
Can you argue, though, that free trade is what causes earnings inequality?
Earnings inequality.
Like, it seems like if earnings inequality is what is ultimately to blame for wage inequality, is that related to, I'm looking at this Brookings. We had this article on Brookings that talking about inequality and whether world trade is to blame. And it argues that earnings inequality and that there are differences in demand for workers with different levels of skill that have a whole bunch of other issues attached to them that aren't specifically related to free trade.
Well, yes,
is it like a little bit of both? Is that why it's so complicated? You can't tease it out?
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, the global economy is a behemoth, and unpacking any one thing from any other thing is not doable, right? Which is why you hear economists say all the time, well, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, it's hard.
Well, and as we talked about, with the textile industry, like, my understanding of free trade is that in the long term, it lifts all boats, but in the short term, some boats sink.
Right. Right. And you saw that with the textile numbers. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to go. I like the audio ones. Leah Dawkins sent in her trade question about American made steel.
My question is this. President Trump says he wants all the oil pipelines in the United States to be made of American steel. While I understand that some steel is still made in America, do we actually make enough steel to construct large scale infrastructure projects entirely with said American steel? Additionally, does the U.S. mine enough iron ore to make all this American steel we are going to need for such infrastructure projects? Thanks.
I'm a guess no.
Yeah, well, right. We make a lot of steel, but for all the infrastructure that we need to fix, we don't make enough steel for that. But here's the other thing, right? I think the genesis of this question was President Trump saying a couple of weeks ago, we're going to make sure all the pipelines that are built in this country are made with American steel, right? After he reauthorized the Keystone XL pipeline. The fact is, we don't make enough steel of the right kinds, right? Because steel comes in like 1,000 different varieties. Mm-hmm. And you need a specific kind of steel for pipelines and a specific kind of steel for bridges and a specific kind of steel for, rebar, right? And the problem is we don't have enough of that supply in this country to meet all of the various demands. So the short answer is no. The slightly longer answer is no.
That is an awesome answer.
Yeah.
All right. Gentleman's choice. One more question.
Okay. One more question. Let's go with, let's keep it audio. Grace from Salt Lake City. Go.
It seems like a weak Mexican economy is going to drive illegal immigration to the United States. We know the net flow has been negative for the last several years. More people are leaving the U.S. than entering it illegally. So how do we square those contradictory policy priorities from the Trump administration, killing NAFTA, but also tightening security on the southern border?
That is an awesome, awesome question. And it goes straight to the heart of what it is that the president's trying to do on the southern border, right? Maybe not kill NAFTA, but certainly renegotiate it more toward our advantage, about which there are problems, as I alluded earlier, but also tightening security on the southern border. I mean, the problem is that if NAFTA negotiations, renegotiations do damage to the Mexican economy, that will make more people want to come, thus challenging the problem, making more challenging the problem of tightening security on the southern border. That's my two cents.
Of course, if they do significant, the reason that we have net negative immigration from Mexico to the United States, though, was the damage to the American economy after the 2008 recession. So if NAFTA renegotiations have the effect of damaging our economy, too, then they won't necessarily increase immigration. But if your approach is America first, you know, I mean, I think you could say the administration is clearly demonstrating it's not worried about what happens to the Mexican economy.
Right. I mean, the president's doing what he said he was going to do. And so you got to take him at his word. And then we see how it all plays out, you know. We have, by the way, a video of the history of NAFTA on our website. It's marketplace.org/makemesmart. Also, having gotten the NAFTA show in the can now, let's move on to tax policy because, holy cow, I have to go see my accountant. Please, please send us your questions about tax policy and what you think the Trump administration is going to bring to American tax policy. We're doing that show a couple of weeks, right? Right before tax time?
Yep, right before tax time. But this is not about doing your taxes or even Kai's taxes.
That is true.
That's
that
for
is
his
true.
Accountant
that is
to
true.
Deal with. But tax policy obviously is still an ongoing question for the Trump administration. So we'd like to know your thoughts. And I would like to know, Kai, what is the thing, speaking of relevant to my interests, I want to know the baseball story.
Right. So I was talking about Carla Hills and Michael Wilson and Jaime Serra, the American, Canadian and Mexican negotiators of NAFTA. And it turned out that and this is a story that Michael Wilson's going to start, the Canadian guy. Things were a little tense in negotiations. And so Carla Hills, the American trade representative, suggested they take a break to go to a baseball game. And here's the tale as told by Michael Wilson.
We did go to that baseball game, and then we broke up about halfway through the game. I think it was around the fifth inning. Jaime Serra wanted to go back to the negotiating table. He couldn't sit still. As we were walking out of the ballpark, there's a huge roar, which I found out the next day was a triple play. And it would have been the only triple play that I would have seen in my life. And I always remind Jaime of that and criticize him deeply for disrupting the game just for a bloody trade negotiation.
He tells this story on himself, too. That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Jaime was a soccer player. He didn't care about baseball. Michael cared about baseball a whole lot. But it's a good story. And it did happen.
So here's why I love that story. First of all, because it's a cute little story, right? With the boots and the bloody baseball game and all that jazz. right? From Michael Wilson.
Has it all.
I know. But here's the deal. Personalities matter. Getting along with people matters. Yeah. Negotiations are hard, and you have to be able to take a break and go watch a ball game. And I think that's just an interesting thing to bear in mind in the current environment.
That seems like a good place to end. Yeah. Thank you all for listening. We got to go. Kai is off getting a tan somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to the East Coast
next
for spring
week.
Break, man. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bonner, Raghu Manavalan, and senior producer Nancy Fargali. Special thanks this week to the production skills of Daisy Palacios and Maria Hollenhorst. This week's program was engineered by Ben Talladay. The theme music was composed by Ben and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, who I'm sure would agree with me when I say, always say you're off getting a tan. Just own it. Bye.
Bye.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.